The first step is taking the first step. I'm a huge believer in the fact that people behave the way they're incentivized to do so. The privilege that we're all raised with and the safety net that we have kind of inbuilt to our lives, the worst case is never the worst case. The worst case is a pretty decent case. When you take a step back, the risk is not as much as people think it is. I'm looking to tell good stories and to tell them to as many people as I possibly can. The film business is a terrible place to get trained. Knowledge is hard to pass down. We pass it down verbally, we pass it down through action, but there's no formal kind of transfer of knowledge.
Ashwin Suresh did something which most people would be intrigued by. Quit a job in investment banking in the US to come to India and start a media business. But what he's been able to do with that, his understanding of why he did it, his learnings from it, and also how he's been actually been able to build that business, something which is deeply insightful for all of us to tap into and learn from. Talk about all of that and more. Before you go there, make sure you hit subscribe and smash that bell icon. Go straight into my chat with Ashwin. I'm happy we're doing this podcast in person because the last time we did a podcast years ago was also in person. I think about 2019.
Yes.
2018.
18 or 19.
18,
yeah.
I think it was my first year as a podcaster. And now, whatever, 500-600 episodes later across all shows, I'm like, so happy to do this.
No, me too. I'm very happy to be here. In fact, I was wondering, that one we did, was that, did we record it on video as well?
No,
because it was a
video.
Whole lot of fun, and we should have had it on video.
We just did audio. Those are the days where podcasts didn't have video show.
And I don't know why we should have had video all the time, right?
So, back in the day when they said, "No, audio doesn't require video." But
it doesn't require it. It was always good to have.
Yeah,
yeah, that was a fun one.
What I always enjoy about talking to you is that you have this insider perspective as an outsider across.
I knew we were going there very soon after
most things, but I want to actually kind of circle back before that. Is saying when you think of yourself growing up, was there something which you said, okay, this is what I really want to focus on as I move ahead in life? Was there a thing there in your head?
No, I was a very unstructured thinker growing up, and I don't think I had thought through what I needed to do in life. There was a playbook and a textbook, I should say, which you had to kind of check off these boxes one by one, which is drilled into you, right? It's kind of that upbringing.
Engineering, MBA.
My parents were never like, engineering hi karna hai. Like, that was never like the thing, but it was encouraged. And, I was not bad at like the science subjects in school, not enough to feel afraid of them. If anything, it was laziness. So I would like, every mark I lost was really out of laziness, not out of a lack of understanding. Engineering just seemed like, okay, this sounds like we should do this. Let's go ahead and do it. There was no real thought. It was not like a second order thought put into it saying, this will help me do X, Y, Z. And today when I see a lot of kids who are in there, like, I don't know, late teens, 20s, who know what they want to do. And even if they change it somewhere down the line, but they have an idea. I'm a little bit jealous because I feel like had I been a bit more thoughtful at that point, I may have been able to shape my life differently. I'm happy with where it's, come to, but who knows? I could have reached this point 5 years earlier.
I asked you this also because, it's in that period in life when I'm actually, sometimes I worry about the ones who are too clear about what they want to do in their late teens, early 20s. I'm like, you're not going to explore and just be like, let's fall over into random places. I want to go to that period mainly because I feel that kind of shapes who we become eventually. I think eventually,
yeah.
Once you cross that period of time when you're trying to figure out where your career is going, everything else, I feel you default back to how you were when you were a kid at some point later in life.
Yeah. I mean, look, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, right? I'm still figuring it out. But at every stage, I've been like gravitating towards something. And I would not let myself kind of go there because it was always like, hey, no, this is off the path and kind of stick to the path. And the path, there was a safety in the path. I think it comes from kind of that, you have a middle class, upper middle class upbringing. There's a sense of safety that's, kind of bred into you. And you want to make sure you don't take too many risks because you could end up worse off than you were growing up. And that's not, who wants to kind of progress backwards. But I think I shared all of that. It took me to like my mid-20s before I understood the idea of risk and reward. And it's funny because I was already an investment banker by then. I should have understood those concepts better. And it was only then that I really kind of quantified the risks to trying out different things. And I found that in most situations, like, the reward was disproportionately higher, and I didn't know why I was not taking those risks. And I think even today, I think about my career in these phases, right? Like, so I think, okay, I spent some time in finance, I've spent some time in the film business, you know, digital content, now I'm in gaming. I'm still asking myself what's next, because I'm not sure that there's any sector or industry or job or business that I want to do for the rest of my life. Like, I just think that's such a huge commitment to make, and I don't think I'm there. I don't think I'm there yet.
I think that's an insight, right? Is that I was talking to someone the other day, I think like 21, 22, and saying, I haven't figured out what I'm going to do in life. And I'm like, that's actually a great place to be, because you can figure stuff out. You dabble with things and you come towards specific moments in life when an opportunity or an idea comes to you and you kind of move towards that. I know you've spoken about this way too often. You've been asked this question because it's one of those things even asked you. At which point did you go from that track of, okay, I'm following the route that even follows, saying, no, I'm just going to like take that one-way ticket to India and get into the media space. How did that happen?
So I'll give you a different answer than I usually give, because this one's filled with more anecdotes. There were three kind of situations or incidents that happened that pushed me closer to that decision. When I was in New York, when I was working in finance, I kind of started to flirt with the idea of the film business as something I could potentially have a career in. At the time, I think it was more pure play creatives, like, hey, I want to direct and I want to be this great director. And I think one situation that happened was I was invited, or I had some pass to a screening for this movie called Loins of Punjab, which was directed by this guy called Manish Acharya. And Manish, I think, like a lot of people, was, I think he'd done like an engineering degree or some traditional degree, worked in kind of the corporate world, and then, said, fuck this shit, I want to do something more meaningful with my life or whatever, and ended up at NYU, and I think this was his thesis film, and I watched it and I said, wow, he's got a bunch of reasonably talented actors, pretty well-known actors together, put a film together that's quite nice. It was received very well in India. I think he was at the start of a very promising career. Unfortunately, he passed away in a tragic accident. But I just thought, wow, somebody had the guts to like break away from that mold and do it. And then the idea got like 5% more real in my head. Then as I was, as I spent a lot of time in New York, I was there right before and during and after the global financial crisis, right? And so I went from working, a bazillion hours a day. Like, there were months where I was getting like 0 days off. I was just working till like midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. every day, and then starting again at 8 a.m. But then that moved after the crisis. Like, I was thankful to keep my job, but that moved to like getting free at like 7 p.m. and not knowing what to do with yourself. Because you're so institutionalized, right? You're institutionalized to having like this little BlackBerry here that keeps buzzing and this like no time on your schedule. And like, your free time was at 2 a.m. You would go hit the club, whichever club was, banging that night, till like 4 a.m. or 5 and everything shut. You go back home, sleep for 3 or 4 hours, back to the office, back at it again. And if you had like an hour or two to kill, you'd go under your desk and sleep, do a quick 30-minute power nap. Or you'd say you're going to the toilet and go to the nap room and just kind of hunker down for like half an hour, right? So that was kind of how you caught up with sleep. And to go from that to this like 7 p.m., what do I do? So I started working as a volunteer at a film festival there, which is now called the NYIFF, the New York Indian Film Festival. It used to be called something else before, the Mahindra Indo-American Arts Council Film Festival. And at that festival, there was one short film by these two young guys who were basically also some corporate turned filmmaker guys. They were doing a short film, and it was just for a lark, and it was called Shore in the City, or it was called Shore. The short film was just called Shore. And those two guys are Raj and DK. And they came and they submitted this film. The film won the best shot at the festival. And I watched the film and I was blown away. It was a 15, 20 minute film, I forget. But the premise was so strong. It was so much fun. I met these guys at the after party. And, they were not well-known filmmakers. They were happy to hobnob with anybody. So I spent like a good half an hour chatting with them. And I learned that they had these aspirations to go become full-fledged Bollywood movie directors. And, I was like, everybody seems to want to do this stuff. It's not uncommon. And of course, they eventually made that film into a feature, which I think Balaji produced. It did reasonably well. And they've had prolific careers ever since. So that was the second incident. And that took me 5% even closer to this idea. And then the third incident was at the same film festival, but a different year, possibly the year after. We were screening Gulal, which Anurag Kashyap had directed. And this, by this time, Anurag Kashyap was already a reasonably well-known name. If you cared about Indian film, you would have heard about him. He was kind of the guy being talked about a lot at that time. And a lot of the other volunteers at the festival were American Indians. So they didn't have as much of an understanding of what was happening in India as I did. And so I positioned myself to be on duty the time of his screening. And when he came in, I got a minute with him and I said, listen, if you've got 5 minutes during the screening, can you step out? I'm manning the ticket desk, but if you can step out, I'd love to chat with you just for 5 minutes. He's like, I'll give you more than 5 minutes because this is the most boring thing ever to watch your own film again and again. I will step out after the opening credits and I will come back. I know exactly how to time when the closing credits are going to come. So I was like, okay, this is even better. So then I got somebody else to take my spot there. And as soon as he stepped out, I said, let's chat. So he said, no, you take me to a bookstore first, then we'll talk. So then I took him, we were at Union Square. I took him to a bookstore. I think it was like Barnes & Nobles or there was a Strand or something over there. And we spent an hour and a half talking and I was just like, it was literally like a kid in a candy store. I was just asking him questions about his career and what he thought of himself as a writer or a director. And it was like, just like an orgasm for me, right? Just when I talk to this guy who I think is one of the most terrific voices to come out of India. And he gave me a patient ear. He gave me some advice. He gave me a lot of, he said, look, just drop everything and come to India. And that's when you'll find, like, you can't build this career sitting over here. You have to like take some hard calls and take those steps. And he said, if you come to India, find a way to reach me and I'll give you a job as an AD or whatever. And he even made me buy 2 books, I think, which he was convinced would transform my life. One was Stranger by Camus and one was Crime and Punishment. And he said, read this and I challenge you will quit your job and move to India or whatever. I read Stranger. I didn't read Crime and Punishment. I still haven't to this date. But that was the third incident where I felt like people are telling me this is possible. But I think there was always doubt, like, is this reversible? Because it's a meaningful decision, but is it a reversible decision? I was also in a pretty serious relationship with Aditi, who's now my wife. And we were considering kind of getting married at the time. So I was like, I can't get married and also move and also try this like weird career. And at some point, like, shadi mein log kahenge yaar dulha karta kya hai? Like, ye matlab kuch nahi karta, naukri chhod diya, kuch nahi kar raha hai. Right? So, there was a lot of like uncertainty around it. I think it came down to eventually the Excel sheet we made. We made this little like sheet and we said, okay, how much does it cost to live in India? If you give yourself 2 years to fail, how much do you spend and what percent is that of your savings so far? And fortunately for us, we were in kind of high finance, working Wall Street jobs, getting paid way more than we deserved. And so we had a cushion. We had, a capital cushion. So it then became kind of an easier path to take. It became less emotional and more rational. I think I needed that. I needed it to be like, I need to convince myself this is a rational decision, not an emotional decision, because I don't know if I can take an emotional decision of this kind of magnitude, right? And so it became kind of like that. And also coincidentally, Aditi was kind of toying with the idea of spending a couple of years working in social development. So everything kind of just came together, and we decided we'll do it. And then we're kind of strong-headed and obstinate people. If we decide we'll do something, we do it. I don't think either of our parents were very happy about it, but until the first time maybe we got quoted in the newspaper or something, they were like, what the hell are you doing with your life? And they saw us in the newspaper, they're like, perfect, keep doing more of this. But yeah, that was kind of the thought process. It wasn't really it was very safe in some sense. It wasn't as brave as it's made out to be. I get asked this a lot, and because we were among the first wave of people to do this back in 2011 or 2010, 2011. Today, a lot of people have done similar things, but we get a lot of credit for it because we were early. But I think it was more sensible than people realize.
Now, I'm taking a few things away from the three, stories you told, right? Is that one is, it's almost like you can have a dream of being in a space, but unless you are even in the smallest way, immersed in it, you are surrounded by people who are in that space. Like, I think that story with Rajan DK is so interesting, right? Is the fact that in hindsight, it would be one of those points where you're saying, okay, this is something which they're doing. This is someone who's already taking that step. And then also asking a lot of questions, because oftentimes in our dreams, we see things very differently from what they really are like. And people are generally worried about asking questions. Will I seem stupid? Will I seem like I'm prodding too much? But when you ask for 5 minutes, you got 1.5 hours.
An hour and a half. Maybe more, whatever the length of the film minus opening credit and closing credit.
We also kind of, I feel that as you get older, the weightage on rational gets far higher than the emotional. Because when you were like 18, 19, or actually even like I remember when Rohit and I took that call to quit. Incidentally, same time.
Just too many parallels in our
yours
life.
Yours was in 2008?
2009? I moved here in 11, but I took the decision in about 10. 9 and 10 is when
so
I took
2007,
the decision.
So 2007, 8 was the financial crisis. Yeah. Rohit and I quit in 2009.
Yeah, I quit.
A bunch of people had told us we were getting promoted, go and take up jobs. And our only calculation, which was terrible in hindsight, I think it was more emotional and less rational because we assumed we had enough money for 3 to 6 months. We had money for a month. In hindsight, we didn't know that you won't get money in advance from clients.
Oh shit!
So we assumed that we'll get a couple of shoots, we'll make money.
Golden rule.
And so we literally after our first shoot, he and I between us had $1,000, and the check hadn't come in. It was going to come in the next day, and it would take 2-3 days to clear because those days you still had to go and put that check in because TV channels would give you a physical check, not transfer
it. You take
it,
that right? And deposit it. Yeah.
And so our head of photography took us for a drink, and we were calculating how much is just each pitcher of beer cost. And by the time the second pitcher happened, we knew that we were over what the tax would add on to it because 500 rupees is what the thing was. And thankfully, he paid the bill, so we were fine. But even at that time, we had done a calculation. Okay, what does Rohit do? What do I do? What can we bring to the table? How long will we survive? When do we say, okay, this is then we'll go look for jobs? Did you have, and I'm guessing that would be all those things on the sheet, like, you know, come to India, then say, okay, this is how we're going to look at it. This is the amount of time we're giving ourselves.
Yeah, look, there were two decisions to make, right? One was like, what do I think I want to do in this business, right? I think Aditi had more clarity about her journey. It was very clear she wanted to work in kind of the impact space, do some social development work. And it was always intended to be a temporary thing. For me, it was this like dream of, oh, I should be a director and I'm going to be this like, you know, great storyteller that the country will get transformed by. And the year that I, you know, I initially wanted to move in 2010, but because we were planning to get married, it, you know, didn't make sense to make all the changes at one time. We deferred the move to 2011. And in that time, we just coincidentally happened to move to a building which was adjacent to the New York Film Academy. And the New York Film Academy, you know, as wonderful as it is very easy to get into if you're willing to spend. I learned that. And I went there and I took this like this filmmaking course. And I didn't learn filmmaking, but what I did learn at the end of it was that I probably wasn't ready to be a director. You know, I didn't make a very good director. But I learned that I have these like other abilities around kind of, you know, project management and understanding story and creative and all of that. And I was like, shit, this is throws a spanner in my works because I've got all these plans now. I've like, you know, kicked a fuss saying I'm going to move to India, but maybe I'm not cut out to be a director. So we said, you know what, never mind. We'll just go there and figure it out. Like maybe you will learn to be a producer or learn to just work in a corporate job there. May as well do a corporate job in the film business than in the finance business. So there was no real like calculation. The Excel sheet was actually much more simplistic. The Excel sheet was simply a function of what is the minimum viable lifestyle in Bombay that makes us not really regret, you know, having grown up in the Middle East and lived in the US for, you know, having lived there for 10 years, not regret that move. And how much does that cost and what percent of your total cash, because there was no other savings, it was just cash. Like you didn't have like, it's not like we bought a house or we had any other assets. It was just, you had cash in the bank. And it was a very manageable number. It was coming to, I don't know, 10 or 15% of our collective savings. And I thought that was a easy risk to take. Like, sure, you wipe out 15% of your savings, but you know, I had done my GMATs. I knew I could get into a business school and, you know, they like these stories, I thought, right? So you just kind of go fail somewhere and tell them, hey, I failed. Would you like to accept me now? Yeah. And, you know, hey, HBS, you know, let me show up now. So that was kind of the safety net is I'll go to some business school. I had reasonable scores in my GMAT. So I figured I'd get in somewhere. So I was never too worried. I was never daunted by the idea of coming here and, you know, this not working out. And it didn't work out. Like, you know, for the first several months, Aditi was, you know, financing our lifestyles. And I would spend most of my time watching Big Boss at home, which I was a big fan of that year. That one specific year, I was a huge fan. And eventually I got off my ass and got a job and it paid enough to cover rent. And that was kind of my stepping stone into that business. And that's when I started to realize, okay, you know, here's what the business looks like. Here's where the opportunities are. And by the end of the 2 years when we were supposed to go back, that's when I started to realize, hey, wait a minute, I need a third year to just to push this a little bit more and see if something can click here. By the end of the third year, we had enough hope that we could build something. So then we're like, give it one more year, a fourth year. By the end of the fourth year, we actually had money. We had raised some capital. Then I'm like, now I'm pot committed, right? Like I can't step out of this now. So it's been a treadmill ever since.
You also started at a time which I feel is very interesting for the space, right? There's a time when this whole concept of content that could be online came in, things you can actually kind of make in the space kind of started to happen. I remember seeing the first set of pieces you guys made as well. And wondering, okay, this is, it seems fresh. It seems like something which I haven't seen before. And we were all like, I think early days of Glitch just come out of music television, doing stuff for brands and like, should do more stuff like that. And I remember at least two people out of our then, I would say 15, 20 member team, walking up saying, why can't we do more independent stuff? I'm like, that's not our business, right? How much do you attribute that period to, like, there were some points that were just luck kind of paid off, saying these are opportunities that kind of showed up, and how much of it was planned? Okay, like we had a hypothesis, it paid off. If you had to go break it down to that.
I think they're linked, right, Varun? I mean, my wife laughs when I say this because I'm a lazy guy, but I think the harder you work, the luckier you get. And, you know, we worked very hard. Like, I have to give ourselves credit for that. We didn't have a very clear idea of what we wanted to do. We knew we wanted to build, I think originally the idea with Pocket Aces was to build a movie studio because we felt the studio system was broken. There was a few ways to fix it. But only when we understood how deep the rot was and how the incentives prevented anyone from letting that get fixed, did we realize, hey, this might not be the best use of our time. You've got two reasonably well-educated guys putting, 16, 18 hours of their day into this thing. And eventually a third person would show up and do the same thing. And we're like, we can't waste that time trying to fix a system where everybody is trying to make sure the status quo persists, right? So the move to digital content happened out of necessity. It happened because we knew we could raise money. We had like the understanding of, venture capital, private equity. We'd worked in these fields. I'd worked in VC before. I'd worked in PE before. So had Anirudh. And Aditi was doing an investing job in Impact, in fact. So we had a good sense for, that we could present a business case to somebody and get somebody to support this financially. But then I can't take that money and go after the film studios because they're just like, overpaid executives working, 4 hours a day and often don't know their head from their ass. Almost every film executive I've met here is like that. And in contrast, the TV guys, I think, were a lot more clued in and understood a lot more about, because they were used to data. They would see their audiences and they would study numbers. And the film guys were just like, which way is the wind going today? Yeah, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And
the data you would get, and I remember there was a time, around that time, you would get this one weekly, I forget what it's called, you'd get this one print thing with data numbers on film and television. The television was still like what?
Yeah, there was that was it Super Cinema, one of those magazines that would send you like the trade report.
Random magazine which had data on cinema numbers, and I would be one of those people sitting and reading that because I was intrigued by it.
Yeah.
But it never made any sense. Like none of the data had.
There's actually a lot of interesting insights out of that data, and I think what the film executives were able to do is some of that became instinct for them, but they could never like. It's like I can draw something in a graph, but if I tell you write the equation for this graph, you have no idea how to do that, right? That's kind of what is happening for them. They could draw the graph, but they couldn't draw the underlying equation. When Ani and I spent time studying these numbers, and we did it as a daily exercise, we'd study every single number that would come out, and we'd get numbers from 3-4 different sources, triangulate. You could start seeing a pattern. There was a point after which we could quite accurately predict how films would do depending on a few key factors. Right? We would, try to quantify the buzz and this and that. We look at some social media stats. And we had a pretty good sense. We're like, okay, this opening day one is likely to be between this range and that range. And we would almost always get it right. So we would compete. We would, bet against each other who'd get it closer. But even the guy who lost would often be pretty close. So I think there is some kind of insights to be derived from there. There's a high amount of correlation between a few data points. But none of that mattered because the, distribution was controlled by kind of the talent. Financing was only provided when the talent was available. And so everything just got, you know, talent took all the value. And I felt like that didn't make sense because you go to like the US market and of course there's, you know, the 1% talent takes huge value there, right? The Tom Cruise movies, you know, Tom Cruise is the most expensive part of the Tom Cruise movie, right? And that's fine. But for a majority of actors, that wasn't the case. Like you could, there were guys who built their careers on like the video cassette movie, right? Or the straight to home or direct to home, you know, DVDs or whatever. You didn't have that industry here. It's starting to form now, 10 years later. But I think that for us, like the goal was, look, try to understand this business from the inside. If you don't think this is fixable, anything can be fixed if the incentives are aligned. I feel like I'm a huge believer in the fact that people behave the way they're incentivized to do so. And I just thought the incentives in the film business were terrible. I mean, I was at an organization where, you know, guys who were making 3, 4, or 5 lakhs annually were buying like 3 BHKs, right? Like you knew that money was not coming from their salary, right? So,
and suddenly show up with a very swanky new car. And
yeah, you'd be like, I remember the, you know, from? The Mahindra had the XUV launch around then, right? It was the big one, XUV 500 or whatever it's called. And these 2-3 guys showing up in these SUVs, I'm like, boss, your salary can't be more than 5 or 6 lakhs annually. How the hell are you affording a 10-15 lakh car? Like,
and there's a layer to it, right? And you what you often don't understand, and anybody who comes into the business realizes, is that the difference between the Indian industry and anything globally is that we are unstructured by design.
it's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, exactly. It's a feature that you are so unstructured in every aspect, from how the studios are, in terms of actually, and how the shoot spaces are, how vendor management happens, how, even like, how do you, I remember once I was having this very intense conversation with production head, and he had this smile because he'd been in the industry for a long time. And I was like, why can't we get people? And I was very naive in hindsight. I said, why can't we just get everybody? We'll give them all bottles. Can't they just come and fill up their own water? Simple ask in hindsight. He said, you know how many people come on a set? I said, I know. He said, but just think about how many people come on the set. How many of them are repeat? Some of them this. So the average Indian set, I think post-pandemic has changed a bit. You would have people for jobs which had no reason to be jobs.
Yeah, it's like at the airports. Have you seen the guys that like, you walk over to the boarding pass scanner and there's a guy there to just look at it and then there's another guy to scan it for you. Like that should be a 0-person job, but there are 2 people employed by that job.
It's now. Like one guy's job is just come, as you enter, he gives you that small bottle of water. That's one guy's job. And then beyond that, it's how safety is structured, how, like you can, I think that's like a, that's a podcast series to
itself. Yeah, by itself, yeah. Call me.
But when you come back, yeah, exactly. And you come back and you say, okay, you don't have to break all of those norms, but there's a better way to actually create the product itself. And I feel that's what's happened since around the time when you guys started off as well, but now.
We did it consciously. Like that was all very, so, because, you know, we didn't know anything about the production business, right? Even in my time at Reliance Entertainment and when I was setting up Jungle Pictures, I wasn't knee-deep into the production itself. I was more like a corporate executive. So I was more focused on kind of set up the structure, set up the film, set up the economics, and then let the teams go and execute. At Pocket Aces, when we did our first shoot is when I understood the true chaos that happens on set, right? And both Anirudh and I looked at each other and, you know, we had hired somebody from the industry to run our production. And this really great woman called Juhi. And we said, Juhi, why do we need all these people there? She said, no, it's just normal. That's how things are. And so then we sat down and we actually sat with her and we broke down what actually happens and why are these people needed? And eventually she came to the conclusion based on the questions we were asking that we don't need so many people. And then we shot, we did a series called Not Fit, which was a 10-part mockumentary series. It was one of the first mockumentaries anyone had done in India. We shot the damn thing with an 18-person crew. Unheard of. And even today, I don't think I'd be able to do that anymore because, again, we've gone back to that kind of, you know, that size and scale, that the inefficiencies that kind of film had gotten to. And, you know, honestly, like, no one was, like, working more than they work in a regular film set. Everyone was working the same amount. We just got it done with less people. So we learned that you can do more with less if you are just, if you ask the right questions and you question everything and break down these things into first principles. And so there was a lot of that involved. And then, of course, there were a few key bets, right? Like you have to have a hypothesis and test those things, right? So a couple of key things that really, like, you know, I feel like people often operate wearing blinkers and they can't kind of, they don't look left and right, or they don't ask the right questions, or they behave like, you know, with herd mentality. And every new content channel or content company that would start would say, hey, YouTube, and we're going to build YouTube and this and that. And, you know, we were reading in the press that Facebook was keen to launch their own native video player, because what was happening back then, if you remember, is people would create a video on YouTube, then they would put the link on Facebook, which would let you embed YouTube links, much to their own loss. And then that's where the discovery would happen. So you would discover it on your social feed, and then you would click and go outside that universe and watch it on YouTube's feed. It didn't make sense that Facebook would let that happen for too long. And so we took that bet. We said Facebook won't let that happen for too long, so let's invest in Facebook native video. So we became the early like viral content creators on Facebook video back in 2014, 2015. And then Facebook suddenly gave us MFN status. They were like on the phone with us often talking about, hey, how are you doing this? How are you creating that? How are you, you know, running the newsfeed? How are you making sure the newsfeed delivers your content to people? So these were just bets we took. And they're not hard bets to take, because the cost of failure is zero. So what if you get it wrong? Just go back to YouTube and do it like everyone else is doing it. Right? You have nothing to lose, but nobody was taking those bets. People were just so committed. I mean, there was some, like YouTube had funded a bunch of these channels. So Google Ventures had put in money into a few companies and channels to only create content for YouTube. That's fine. I get that. You're financially incentivized to behave that way. But I had no financial incentive to do that. I was a, you know, venture funded or a family office funded business. I could take these calls on my own. And so we took those bets. And I think we got lucky because we were smart and hardworking enough to take those bets. So that happened multiple times. It wasn't just the one time. It was that way till we raised our next round of funding, that way for a bunch of key decisions, that way when we took a call to start Loco, and how we did that too. We could have gone down and built our own, you know, gaming app, but we found a team, a really smart team doing that already in Bangalore. So we went and acquired the team versus building it ourselves. So you've got to kind of take these calls, and you'll get many of them wrong, more of them wrong than right. But if there's some thought to it, I think you get lucky quite often.
One of the things which, from what you're just saying, and when I've seen you guys evolve over time, is that there's this common thought process that you got to pick one lane as a business or as a person, stick to that and go deep into it. That's how you kind of grow. And that is said a lot more about businesses now. I think people say it less about individuals, because the assumption is, what's your side hustle? All that stuff comes in. But even for businesses, what we often don't look at is that you don't have to stick to one thing that you do and one area of focus. Like, you guys have just been able to expand towards multiple spaces and evolve. And that actually makes you seem a lot more balanced as well.
Although that's true, I wish that weren't the case. Right? I wish that India economically allowed you to kind of build depth. I just don't think this market has that much depth yet, right? If you really, like, beneath all these great, okay, we're the largest population in the world now and most young people and all, we're, you know, for most businesses that are not kind of very mass medium businesses, just like, you know, the content we create is not, I mean, it's mainstream, but it's not like, you know, the 1.2 to 1.5 billion people are not watching it. It's the top kind of 100%, 100 million people that from an income perspective that are actually consuming it. I think most of these businesses cater to 100 million people. So we're not a 1.5 billion person economy. We are, for all the problems that we have, population challenges, we have, you know, a low GDP per capita, we have all of those issues like a 1.5 billion population country does. But our economic might, unfortunately, is limited to 100 million, you know, people that transact and that purchase and that have disposable income and that can actually continue to fuel the economy. And so I wish we could create more depth, and I wish we could do one thing and do it so well that we would just exports of that one thing. But unfortunately, India doesn't give you, there's no depth in revenue. You can't, you know, I was in the US last year, and I was at one of those strip malls, you know, that has many stores. And there was a store that just had, it was like a large superstore, like the size of, like, you know, one of these hypermarts we have in Bombay. So, you know, 20 different aisles, and each aisle goes down like, you know, 50, 100 feet. It was just for kayaking and canoeing equipment and accessories. Just that. You wouldn't even find like fishing equipment there. Just kayaking and canoeing. And it was a chain. It wasn't like a standalone mom and pop shop. It was like a chain. They had stores in multiple zip codes. And I was just thinking, I'm like, how much depth does the canoeing and kayaking you know, industry have in America with some total of 300 million people or 400 million people. We can't do that for, we can't even have sporting goods chains in India yet. We don't have that kind of depth, right? So I wish, you know, we could build that, but I don't think we're there yet. I think we'll get there. I'm very optimistic, but you have to build multiple revenue lines as a result, right? So we have these, we have, you know, the content we create for advertisers, but then advertisers are not going to spend a shit ton of money on just this one medium. And so then, okay, we have talent management. And so we have these influencers. Can you spend some money in, through that pocket? And then it's like, hey, who else is willing to spend money on content? Hey, it's the streaming platforms. Let's go to them. So you kind of have to find all the sources of revenue aggregated, and then it kind of amounts to something. That's just the nature of our you know, economy so far. I think that'll change. I'm already seeing it change.
Yeah, I also brought that up because that's often where, especially in India, people get it wrong, is that you assume there is depth without realizing there is not depth. And there's almost a call you have to take as an individual and as an entrepreneur, right? Is that it's not about you, it's about making the business grow and sustain. And to take the, I feel it's often an ego thing as well, right? You believe that, no, I'm, and I find this very often lately, is that someone says that I'm building this for this, and that's all I'm going, that's what we're going deep into. And it doesn't matter how the economics seem, everything else. But the fact of what you just said, that you have to be this way for this.
I mean,
it's a call that you take.
It's a call you take depending on what your objective is, right? Yeah. Like, if your objective is to do something that fulfills you a certain way without emphasizing the economic return, if, let's say if that's your own investment, your own money, then, you know, I think it's fine to do that too. I think it's nice, in fact, if somebody has that purpose driven. For me and for the companies that I run, we have a fiduciary responsibility, right, to shareholders. We have taken external capital. We have shareholders beyond the three of us. And so we are meant to generate returns. So I have to think about this from a economic POV as well. It's not like I'm not, like, yes, there are things we don't do even for economic returns, right? That I won't do, you know, propaganda content, or I won't do something very religious or political, or, you know, something incendiary, right? Because those are the value systems that we'll kind of, you know, create and use that to mark the line. But outside of that, I have to think economically. I have to think, you know, we're a for-profit enterprise. We're meant to generate returns to all shareholders. And so it doesn't allow us then the freedom to simply focus on one thing and go really deep. I mean, I'm really passionate about storytelling. I enjoy the shows that I get to show run and the shows that I create. If I had my way, I would just sit and do that all day long. I would do one show a year, sit on the beach the rest of the time, have a great life. But I don't get to do that because that's not, and then I should fund that lifestyle myself, right? I can't go take venture funding, take a salary from a company, and then just kind of do that. So I feel like that depth argument is for people who are, you know, who are focusing on economic returns. Because there is only, I still think there's only one way to generate economic returns, is to find multiple sources of revenue and really build as much depth as you can with each line. There are businesses, however, that are single source revenue stream and they do well, but those are very few. There are very few markets in India, very few markets or sectors in India where there's that kind of depth. I mean, I think education to some degree has depth. I think religion is a great business. It has depth. But, you know, there's not a lot of sectors. Like, media and content certainly isn't one of those.
I'm circling back to something you said earlier. You said that you were lazy.
I'm very lazy.
In no context with everything else that you've said, does that laziness seem like it's a problem?
I can give you Aditi's number. You can ask her. No, it's weird, right? I've got these modes. My default state is lazy. I spend more time in a day lying down than sitting or standing. This is like factual information. And now with this kind of hybrid and work from anywhere model, I'm doing a lot of calls lying in bed or lying on a, you know, I have a day bed in my study. So I'm just a lazy guy. I however, do have like a strong work ethic in that. And those are two different things. It's not, you can have a strong work ethic and be lazy, because it's, I have a responsibility to my team, to my co-founders, to my shareholders, to people. So I have to work and I have to work hard, but I do it, you know, the chance I get to be lazy, I will exploit to the fullest as well. And so when I'm not working, when I don't have a commitment, I'm just on my ass the whole time.
So there's a question I keep getting asked online, and people, I feel it's like a continued thread. People are saying, oh, how do I stop being lazy?
Why do you want to stop
being lazy? You seem very productive. I feel I'm lazy, so I'm not productive. And I've always felt that you can be productive and be lazy.
Yes, isn't that the best?
It's the best thing, right?
Yeah.
How are you productive and lazy?
I'm productive and I need to be productive. At all other times, I don't function. I'm just not functional. I have like things I need to do and I do those things because that comes from your work ethic. And then the rest of the time, I just don't like to do anything that I don't need to do. And so I'm lazy to run errands. I'm lazy to like do household chores. I'm lazy to do, I don't know, just anything. I just like to bum around. Like the best days are like when I have actually no agenda, then I'm just like bumming around all day. I could be productive. I could be useful. I could, you know, unpack that one box that has been lying there for the, you know, 11 months it's been since we moved. But no, I'm just too lazy to do it. So I will not do it because I'll just be lying down watching TV instead or watching a rerun of something for the 50,000th time. Because that's just who I am as a person. I'm you know, I keep joking with Aditi that I wasn't designed for hard work. So this is kind of like, you know, I'm doing it. It's like not normal for me. And I need to find a way. It's like it's temporary. And it's, I said it has to stop at some point. I'm designed for laziness. It's been 10 years so far though. So I don't know when it's going to stop. I started working hard from 2007 when I took my first job. And that was a job in finance. So it's been, 15 years now. So I need to at some point like stop working hard. It's around the corner.
I always believe there's a trick to laziness, which we often... So I actually was talking to my coach a while back, and she told me that if you go back to history, if you go back to like ancient man, like, you know, Stone Age man, laziness was almost an inbuilt thing built into you. Your body's saying you need to conserve energy. Because for them, it was like if you're active all day long, and I say really tired by evening, and then like a beast comes to attack you, you have no energy to run away. So the body is almost telling you like you need to conserve energy.
And you have to work harder for food at that point. Exactly. Because you need more food.
Yeah. And so you're almost defaulting to I need to conserve. And while that stayed as muscle memory or whatever, brain memory, all these centuries, millennia later, it's just that. Is that it's almost you're training yourself to conserve energy as much as possible. That's what I try to tell myself when I'm lazy. Yeah, I'm just conserving energy.
It's a nice
energy.
Excuse.
I'm not being lazy. I'm just conserving energy.
I think I should use this. Yeah.
And also I think laziness gives you a point where while you might be lazy right now, your mind's still working, right? Mind's still doing something.
Yeah, that's the curse. My mind doesn't stop. Does your mind ever stop? Yeah, this is the problem. How do you, like, I think maybe meditation or something. I need to like evolve to that level of human where I'm able to like meditate and, you know, kind of control my thoughts, but I'm constantly thinking of something or the other. And I've like started to develop stimulus addiction. I need some stimulus or the other. So I'm either on my phone, I'm reading something, or I'm reading a book, I'm watching TV, I'm like talking to somebody. Like I have to have some activity. I can't remember the last time I sat down, just kind of stayed quiet with my thoughts. And those people that do that say it's extremely rewarding. I don't believe them. So I need to find out for myself. 10's a lot. I can do like a minute and then, or maybe two. But yeah, I need to find out for myself if that's indeed as rewarding as people make it out to be.
I think it's good to do, but I personally believe, and I know you'll agree with me, is that there's nothing wrong in letting your mind be on like thinking mode all the time. As long as it's not something which is really draining you out, because I feel you enjoy it, then you should just do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I've been telling myself as well. I enjoy it. I have this like terrible paranoia about like, if I don't use my mind, it'll just like wither away. It's like, if I don't use it, if I don't keep it like energized, or if I don't keep exercising my brain, I'll just get really dumb. And that's a big fear. And part of this comes from the fact that I never use, like growing up, like I never used my brain beyond whatever I needed to, like just the bare minimum, which is like, okay, study for some exam and that's it. Don't think about too much else. Like, you know, focus on emotion rather than brain. And when I went to college, it was the first time I saw people all around me who had been working out that muscle for so long that the brain muscle was working full flow. And I was like, wait a minute, is this how people are supposed to be? So that transformation for me happened in like my late teens and early 20s. And it's been so rewarding that I don't want to lose that again. So I've got this like fear of like not utilizing my brain enough. And so I keep doing it.
Also, it's tough to bring it back to full flow then, right? Because if you're letting it... And I've actually seen this. There was a period when I really tried longer meditations, or I tried to like longer switch offs, and I would find it much tougher to come back into like getting back into things. Because I feel at some point you get so used to it mentally and this thing that it gets tougher for you to switch back on. Like,
yeah, I've never known that, because I never reached that stage of mental peace.
Right period for me. That 10-minute mark for me has been it. It's been perfect. Guided meditation, 10 minutes. It's not just me in silence. Just me in silence, I don't think I'll reach 10 minutes. But guided meditation, 10 minutes is what I've been able to reach.
Yeah, guided meditation is probably the answer. Because when I'm doing like, when I do like even a bit of yoga at home, I'll put on like some yoga channel on TV and follow what they're doing. And I often just have the urge to keep an article open on my phone so that between poses, I just scroll and continue reading it and doing my yoga pose. So I need to like get over some of those primitive urges first and understand what that's like.
So you technically don't take a pause. Your pauses also involve activity.
I don't, man. I really don't. And I think it's a bad thing. It must be a bad thing. It can't possibly be good. But I don't. I don't take enough of a pause. I mean, when I'm sleeping, I'm sleeping, which is kind of the pause I take. And thankfully, I don't wake up remembering my dreams or anything. So at least that brain function, whatever's happening there, I don't have to deal with the burden of that when I wake up. But otherwise, I'm always on, like always thinking of something.
If you look at yourself from the time you decided to move to India to now, how have you seen yourself change during this period?
I have a lot more clarity about what I want out of life. I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, like I said at the start of this. But I do know the state of mind that I'm looking to be in. I have experienced periods of that through this journey as well. And I very much like the feeling of that. And I want to find a way to make that a more permanent and sustainable state of mind. I have, to my own horror, come to learn and come to appreciate the benefits of human relationships. And I've become more dependent on my relationships than I ever was. I always considered myself a very independent, not, you know, connected to any other individuals, very individualistic person. But now I have formed relationships with, you know, both family as well as friends and others, and even professional relationships, where I feel a certain like dependence on that, and it fuels me. I derive energy from it. And I think that in many ways for me as a person, as a personality, I always lacked confidence growing up. I was never one of those people that believed he could do whatever he wanted, or, you know, was in the front of kind of the limelight. I was always kind of in the back a little bit, but I've gotten more comfortable with the limelight. I've gotten more comfortable with myself, with being confident, with being with my abilities. I was also often underestimated growing up, and so I had a chip on my shoulder. I was always out to prove something, that no, but I'm better than, you know, you think I am. But I no longer have that restlessness. I'm very shant. I'm happy. I'm not one of those guys that's on social media doubting how great my life is or my business is or whatever. I put out whatever content makes me feel happy, and I'm not trying to do it for others anymore. And that so a lot of that has been over the last 5 or 6 years that changed. So I'm very happy with the version of myself today.
How did that relationship with confidence change? Do you think there was a specific point?
Success.
Where that happened?
Success. Very simple. Success. You have to be successful at one or two things, and that makes you feel more confident. And I don't mean success as in that I'm some successful person, but I mean that there have been endeavors that have been successful, right? So whether it's, you know, getting the job you wanted, or getting a GMAT score that you were proud of, or starting a company, like just, it could be small milestones, it could be little things like appearing in a newspaper, like whatever you attached self-worth to, or some amount of validation to, if you were successful, that got, I mean, in my case at least, that gave me a lot of internal confidence. So I got to that point pretty quickly, because, you know, I wasn't looking for a lot. I never thought of myself as underconfident, but I never had demonstrable or tangible success. And so there was always a chip on my shoulder that, hey, I have to prove to the world that I'm good at some things. And the minute I had two or three of those examples, I was done. I'm like, okay, you know what? I'm not in this race anymore. I've checked that box. And I'm, so my checkboxes are different from the traditional, you know, Indian parenting checkboxes, but there are checkboxes nonetheless. And it took some time to realize that. But yeah, success is for me the only thing that, that's all it took to fix the confidence.
You know, you said the chip on the shoulder, right? Is that I feel it also comes from, and I don't know how, if you face it, I know it was for me. I was always that he has so much potential, but if only.
Yeah, yeah. Same. Man.
I was
same,
that.
Same.
And I feel that adds on, I think, through your school, and I don't think college. College, I was like, he's waste of time was how my engineering period was. But that adds to it, right? As much as you might believe, I don't care about this. This adds a little
but
bit.
But did you consciously try to work that chip off your shoulder, or was it something that happened as your life progressed?
So weirdly for me, I used to love to code till I was in my 12th.
Same.
There are too many parallels, man.
Yeah, this is a bit freaky.
I still love to code. I never got below 99 out of 100 in coding.
Okay. Through, that's where we separate. That's where our paths diverge.
Through school. Didn't get into computer engineering because didn't. Terrible, not great at math, not great at physics.
But you wanted to. You wanted to do computer engineering.
I used to enjoy coding, but I would always get pulled down in hindsight for adding layers to the code I would write by making it fun. So if someone said, write a program for a weather report, you press 1, you get temperature, press 2, you print this. And I would have an ad that I would create which come in between those, which wasn't part of the program. So the teacher would say, why have you done this?
Right.
Follow protocol. I'm like, but this makes it fun.
Yeah, one for you, one for me.
Yeah. So that was always my thing. And then eventually did an engineering, but did mechanical, which, and I think engineering sucked out any love for coding or or any of that
same
engineering side which I same had. And but I think back and I said that maybe it wasn't the coding aspect that I enjoyed the most. It was just the code is creative.
Yes, it's so creative. It's so much fun. And the attention to detail that you need to have. I find it really funny because in India, most people don't dot their I's or cross their T's, right? Punctuation's bad, spelling's bad, grammar is bad. We over-capitalize the shit out of every word. But when it comes to coding, everyone's created equal because you just can't fuck with the compiler. You have to have just code that adheres to the syntax, and any deviation from that results in code that doesn't compile. So I've always found that irony quite delicious.
I never pushed beyond it. I feel that by the time I flunked through my engineering, I didn't necessarily know what I wanted to do. Like, I had no like, oh, I love doing this, let me do that. For me, it is always like, and again, parallel, I always wanted to work in the media space. I didn't know what that meant. For me, that meant MTV Channel V. That's literally the only thing I watched.
And you went and did that.
So I came to Bombay eventually at some point. First place I worked at was MTV. Second place I worked at was Channel V. Literally worked in those two places, right? And I feel the chip went off from there because I kind of found, oh, I can do this. And even when we started the company, it was because we were like, worst case, we'll get jobs because you know people will give us jobs.
That's the thing, right? If you think about like the privilege that we're all raised with, and the safety net that we have kind of inbuilt to our lives, the worst case is never the worst case. The worst case is a pretty decent case. And I wish more people would realize that because a lot of my friends when we were moving were just looking at us aghast and they were like, why are you doing this? Are you kidding? Like, how will you get a green card or come back to the US? Or like, you know, you're giving up like this career, there's so much money. And, you know, by then I was 4 or 5 years into finance. So I was making reasonable money. Why would you take these risks? But in fact, I actually left a guaranteed cash bonus on the table and a six-figure cash bonus on the table and came back. I think I needed to stay another 6 months to get that bonus. But 6 months was feeling like too much. But people always look at, and today, obviously, over time, you know, we've thankfully done well enough that I don't regret the economic loss there, at least. But I feel like that risk is, when you take a step back, the risk is not as much as people think it is. And I think that there's always safety nets, there's always like a plan B, there's always a way to get back into it. But most people are too scared to take that first step. But the first step is taking the first step.
You know, you worked somewhere, you build that level of this thing. So worst case, like you said, you could either say, okay, this is an experience I've had, so can go get that MBA or kind of move towards getting a job if it didn't work out or any of those things. But the problem happens is that if you haven't built that in, you have to have so much more conviction in yourself.
Yeah, or if you hate what you do, like that's the thing about me, right? I actually didn't hate my jobs. I've not hated any of my jobs so far, thankfully. And I was good at my job too. I quite enjoyed finance. I was doing pretty well. When I left the last firm I was with, they even, you know, suggested, hey, if you change your mind and want to come back, give us a shot. We'll be open to the conversation, right? So I never felt like those doors were closed for me. I could still do a finance job today and be okay with it, right? Like I enjoy that stuff. It's just that I wanted to try these other things out and it felt like a good time to do it. It felt like I was young enough to take that bet. A lot of people at the time counseled us to take the bet, to defer that bet. They say, hey, build a career. Once you put a bunch of money away, like once you're in your like 50s, you'll have so much money that you can do whatever you want at that point. But I feel like your mind at that point may not work the same way. Your body may not work the same way. And God knows the last 10 years, my body stopped functioning in the way it was designed to function. Like, you know, I'm going on a trek tomorrow morning with a few friends. And I haven't trekked in like, I don't know, like 10 years. We're going on a hike. And I'm terrified that my body's not going to function. I'm terrified my, you know, ankle's going to give way, or my knee's going to hurt, or I'm going to fall on my ass. Like, it's just, you know, body doesn't work. So you got to do these things when you're young, when you're, you know, nimble-minded and fit and able.
Also, when you take these calls, it becomes an interesting decision, right? Like, when you were talking about giving up on that bonus, I remember we had just quit. Channel, we had a three-month notice period. So Rohit and I quit literally on the same date. He resigned, came out. He said, I've resigned. I said, wait 1 second. I sent an email out, went on shoot. I remember in my second month, the first month was done. And I had only one chip on my shoulder through that early career of mine, which is that I didn't get to work on roadies on shoot. So I was a guy who did research, worked on all the other reality shows that MTV had at that point in time. So it still hadn't happened yet, or maybe happened after I left. And I really wanted to go on roadies. It was one of those things I wanted to do. I get a call saying, are you open to coming and being one of the producers on roadies, right? It's almost like, you know, it's that the universe is throwing a test at you. Test like, how much are you committed to this? Because we didn't even have an idea for the company. Like, we had nothing. We were just two people, said we'll figure it out. I remember sitting there saying, this is the one thing I always wanted to do. But I said, that's like a short-term spike.
Right? Why not do it and then quit? And why not defer your plan by 6 months?
We'd both already quit. So Rohit had already quit. So he would have to figure something else to do. And roadies is a long commitment.
But had Rohit not quit, had he been in a position where he was going to submit his resignation the next day, would you guys have deferred it? It's like, it can't be more than a one-year commitment.
He was
right?
going to defer it. He wanted to go out and make ad films. So the idea was never to start a company for us. Rohit wanted to go out and make ad films. I wanted to go out and produce and see what can be made. And we were roommates and best friends. We said, let's just do this together. And because I didn't want to direct. I never wanted to be a director. I always wanted to be a producer. And I used to edit. So it was one of those, like, but if that call had come before either of us have resigned, I would have gone and done roadies. I would have done that because it's almost 6 months to earn at that time. I don't know how it is now. 6 months to an 8 months commitment to do that one show.
Yeah. But for me, that time felt like too long to wait. And it was, it was a good chunk of money for me. Like even today, you know, it would make a difference to my net worth, my savings. But I knew if I didn't take the step, I would never take it. Because, you know, when you get that, then the next bonus is, you know, 12 months away. And then the next one is 12 months away. And the numbers only keep getting bigger. So I needed to do it before the numbers got big enough for me to not take that.
So it's a long-term gut, right? It's like long-term.
It was not gut though for me. I didn't, if I had put a probability on my chance of success, it was quite low. But for me, the cost was, once I realized the economic cost is so low, then I was just a no-brainer. You have to just do it. Even if your chance of success is 1%, the economic cost is nothing. It's 15% of your total savings of 4 years. I can easily work 4 years more and make...
See, finance people figure this out. I feel like when you work in finance, you're like, you put a probability percentage to it.
Yeah, you don't expect value, right?
We did nothing.
I did, unfortunately.
Terrible with maths in general. And I think about it, I handled finance for glitch for the first 6-7 years of our business.
Oh, you apologize in the name itself, right? There is a glitch.
Yeah, so. Always apologize. Like I said, when finally somebody else started to oversee, like, what has happened for the last 6 years? Like, we survived. And I brought that up because I feel that this again becomes a question which many people have, right? I need to make and look at opportunities as equal versus it's never equal. Because it's like, you know,
I hate this like apples to apples comparison because it's fucking apples and oranges. Yeah,
the bonus is not equal to you moving to India. Now there's so much there. Have you ever thought back on any of the choices that you made and said, okay, maybe we could have done some things differently?
Tactical choices, yes. Longer term career and life choices, not so much. I'm pretty happy with the choices I took. Yeah, there are tactical choices. Like, yeah, we could have executed the strategy better at the company, or we could have chosen to do that content differently, or we could have hired a different person for this role, like those sorts of things all the time. But no, I think we moved. Dude, we were also, I mean, you know, I played down luck a little bit earlier, but we were also lucky with our timing. You know, we moved in 2010, 2011, when India was on the cusp of this digital revolution that we're you know, which is underway today. We were 5 years away from Jio being rolled out. We were, you know, 3 years away from 3G showing up. We were a couple of years away from smartphones being, you know, starting to become pretty mainstream. We were 3 or 4 years away from the internet becoming mainstream. We were 5 years away from, or less than 5 years away from YouTube becoming mainstream. So you really couldn't have chosen a better date to get into this business if you knew everything that you know today. And so in that sense, our timing was perfect. We were also at the beginning of the venture capital boom in India, right? If you think about where the tech ecosystem is today, it's 2010, 2011 is when the first kind of signs of that eruption were there. So in a sense that I think we got lucky with the timing. And then we, you know, created our luck by, you know, taking some decisions there and taking some opportunities that we found in our path. So yeah, I don't have any regrets, thankfully. Not yet anyway.
And apart from what you got from that couple of hours, Anurag Kashyap, when you moved to Bombay, when you set this whole thing up, over the years, was there a piece of advice that you got that stayed with you?
Hard to pin down any one thing. So the interesting thing was when I came to India, I didn't take Anurag on his offer. I didn't reach out to him. And in fact, I've probably met him once in the 10 years I've been here. And I don't know if he knows that I'm that person. And I never reminded him of that. And I didn't want that job because I didn't want to...
ED.
No.
Or director in that sense.
No, I mean, to be a director, eventually, I think that ED path would have been interesting. But I felt there was the easy option. And I felt like it would just be like, okay, so you basically, somebody said something once, you took him up on that and you never saw anything else out there. But I wanted to go figure it out myself and understand what the ecosystem was like. Eventually, I got a corporate job even here, right? So some level of that fear and safety net kind of concepts were playing on my mind as well. But I never got any... Honestly, like the film business is a terrible place to get trained. I was thankful that I came from a background which... So finance industry trains you really, really rigorously, right? Finance and consulting are industries that train you a lot. But the film industry, the training is on the job. Like you can train on a film set. You can go on a film set, you learn. But there's nobody... Like I think culturally, we don't document enough of our processes and our thinking and our frameworks. And so there's knowledge is hard to pass down. We pass it down verbally, we pass it down through action, but there's no formal kind of transfer of knowledge, right? And so we end up, there's like this information loss that happens at every stage, which results in huge inefficiencies. And I think that's why as a culture, we don't necessarily have enough good advice to give, or we give or we preach. Those are the kind of the two extremes, right? So I don't think I got a lot of good advice. I got a lot of people telling me this was the wrong business for me. Very early on, like in the first job as well, people were like, why the hell are you here? What are you going to do here? You know, from Wall Street, like this is a, you know, it's a terrible business and all of that. But I was like, but, you know, in that is the opportunity. A lot of people were against the idea of digital content back then also. Mm-hmm. 2011, 2012, the film industry, like these films would have like a 5-10% digital marketing budget in their P&A budget. And when you question that, they were like, digital, yeah, that's just a niche audience. And they were not wrong because those were the numbers at the time. But I think there was never an eye to the future. So I've been very conscious and made it my point that any entrepreneur, anyone in their journey or career seeks advice or seeks help, I try to share whatever information I have or whatever knowledge I have, because I felt at that time that it could have been so much easier had I learned a lot of things from people. I had a very good first boss, and that was kind of the, you know, it's not like she gave me advice ever, but the training proved useful there because she was very generous with her Rolodex. She would introduce me to anyone and everyone, take me to all the meetings. And in fact, I got to start Jungly Pictures with her later on. We were like the two people that started it. So that was, you know, I think that was again a kind of good fortune that came my way. But yeah.
So you would flip that around and say, today, if I'm someone who doesn't come from the media industry, decide to take that leap to come and do something here, what would your advice be?
The first step is to take the first step. I think a lot of people suffer from an analysis paralysis. They're always like analyzing, should I do this, should I not? Here's the math, here's this, here's that. I mean, do some basic math because you need to understand what your kind of plan B and your safety is. But take the move first. If you don't make the move, there's no second step from there. I also think that you know, don't be, you know, I think one of the things that we were very careful not to do was be restricted by the prevalent rules in the ecosystem, right? There's like a set of unwritten laws that you have to obey or you're a persona non grata. And we never did that. We never stuck to those laws. We just always worked outside of the system. And that's okay. We didn't, I'm not looking to be on the cover of some film magazine or, you know, at some, you know, the center stage of some big award function. I'm looking to tell good stories and to tell them to as many people as I possibly can. And there are ways to do that without kowtowing to these rules. So for anyone looking to get in, I would suggest that they find kind of these alternate paths, unless they're very comfortable with the status quo and in, you know, but it's hard to get into that. And there are enough alternate paths, there are enough opportunities. You know, think content plus distribution equals success, and find a way to find content and distribution, you know, avenues.
You know, I always like to leave chats at a point where I'm like, we can go on for a while, but I know there's more to do, and it's become a standing thing that I end every conversation, every episode with saying, we'll always leave enough for a part two to do, to take this ahead. And
we,
I feel
but like, we don't, we should not wait 5 years for the next
one. We'll not wait 5 years for the next part two. And also that idea, which we had midway through of what happens when you first enter the media business in India, is a podcast to itself. And that's maybe a conversation for a separate show altogether.
Yeah, we should do that. That'll be a fun one.
Yeah. Thanks so much for doing this, man. This is fabulous.
Dude, my pleasure. So much fun. Thank you.